take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
Brain Coma.
Chapter 22. Gurning, but not earning.
If you live in each other's pockets, you're bound to resent any small change. By that, I mean that the slightest affectation in those conditions will be scrutinised, held up for ridicule, and systematically taken apart at every opportunity. We were all guilty of it, but we couldn't help ourselves. It was just a damn good way of passing the time. Everything from the way you dressed to your choice of reading material, Angling Times, Men's Health, The Daily Star, was fair game that with enough time and effort could be construed as irrefutable proof that you were coming out of the closet, you big tart. But the person who provided us with the richest seam to mine by far was Billy. His transformation from punk bother boy to sage-like guru gave us a wealth of material. It began when one of his neighbours introduced him to the teachings of G.I. Gurdjieff, the Armenian mystic, a philosophy that Billy embraced totally, instantly and devoutly. And before long, it was permeating every move he made. His new mentors warned him against evangelically spreading the word. But you know how it is with something new. With the best will in the world, you can't keep a lid on it. And talk of its positive attributes leaked out of Billy like gas from a burst pipe. The upshot of this was that far from being its greatest advocate, he unwittingly became its worst ambassador, dragging its good name through the mud with every pontification. AF seized upon Billy's metamorphosis like a Rottweiler on a trouser leg. Indeed, we all saw it as a gift from the gods in the relentless contempt-heaping exercise our time together amounted to. It rapidly became known as the Gurn and Gurning, a deliberately misheard catch-all phrase to denigrate his every utterance. Though this choice of verb did cause some confusion amongst third parties. For months, my girlfriend Jo was convinced that Billy spent most weekends pulling grimacing faces through a horse collar. Though I'm equally convinced that if he had, we would have taken the piss out of him a good deal less. As for Billy, I think he found an almost ascetic pleasure in the abuse we meted out, seeing it as the necessary spitting and beating endemic on any Christ-like road to redemption. Thus, he never failed to keep us fueled with behavioural targets. One time, Al went round to visit him and found him sitting naked in the garden, lotus position, in the middle of December. The object was to raise awareness of corporal existence on the physical plane. An objective he achieved, if a subsequent bout of the flu qualifies. On another occasion, concern about the limp he was displaying revealed there was a stone deliberately placed in his shoe. And again, awareness was the key. But it was the inevitable lapses in wisdom that provided the cruelest juxtapositional laughs. One time, we were walking down the street in Cambridge, Billy lecturing us on the importance of awareness, and Bill and me sniggering into our beer, when without warning, a shell-shocked and clearly haunted Terry Waite passed us by. Bill and I exchanged glances of an, isn't that, what's his name, nature. Billy typically saw nothing, but I will say that I much preferred the post-Gurn Billy to the old one. And in a way, it was his salvation, causing him to question everything and accept situations with placid neutrality. And with some of the ones we got ourselves into, believe me, that was the wisest way to go about it.
Chapter 23. The Wezin Singer. Sooner or later, someone asks you to play at their wedding, and we as a band were no exception, but did so only twice that I recall. One time was for AF's brother Gaz, a night that was memorable for AF's mum upbraiding him between songs for it being too loud, and I also dimly recall a police raid and a distant guest offering to furnish Phil and me with snuff movies. All in all, a damn fine night out. For unique spectacle, you have to go a long way to top Phil's wedding. We didn't play, but we turned up for the ceremony in dome head stage gear to give it that military passing out parade feel. The bride and her father entered the registry office to the strains of Steve Vai, flanked either side by pointy-headed aliens. It was like the final scene of Star Wars. The only other wedding we played at was for a guy named Eddie, who lived in Ludlow, Shropshire. He was something of a hippie, as were all the guests, and I assume his bride-to-be, and the event took place in a rural village hall out in the countryside. He was originally from St. Helens, but had relocated for the peace and solitude of the country life. Therefore, quite a few Tellinses were amongst the invited, including Gaz in his bus. My only memory of the gig is that Scrumpy was in plentiful supply, and I remember playing keys while AF simultaneously attempted to pour the contents of a gallon container down my gullet, an impressive but perhaps overly ambitious feat, but one that the crowd appreciated nonetheless. It was that kind of show. After the gig, we were invited to stick around and join in the after-hours sessions in the bar, which due to its isolated location was unlikely to experience any restrictions of the licensing laws ever, and true to form we refused. We'd adopted the habit of scarpering at the first opportunity to expedite the unavoidable driving and lifting that lay ahead after every show. It was a symptom of concert fatigue and the ever-encroaching demands of aspects of our lives outside the band. But ironically, it made the ordeal even harder to stomach, robbing most shows of any chance of post-performance shenanigans. AF, however, was never one to pass up a piss-up if it could be avoided, and as Gaz was staying over, he talked me into joining him with the promise of a lift back in the morning. Well, I was up for a laugh, and I couldn't see any harm in it, and that was the genius of AF. With him, you never could, but in the back of your mind, you knew it was hiding in there somewhere. After helping load the van, we waved the others off and settled down in the bar, where the locals had just finished their pub quiz. Gaz and the others joined us for a spell, but before long they returned to the bus, and it was just me, AF, and a tight-knit community, and we sat and drank our ales relatively undisturbed, or so it seemed, except there was a nagging feeling that the locals were stealing conspiratorial glances at us, and we both began to feel a creeping uneasiness. I wasn't sure if he was winding me up or not, but AF suddenly began saying we ought to think about getting out of there before something happened. He seemed genuinely scared and went on to point out two big guys propping up the bar. They'd stepped right out of Deliverance with their ruddy faces and beer bellies spilling over their tweed trousers, and they were looking over at us and winking. AF was convinced that they were going to gang rape us and was putting off going to the gents in case they followed him in. In the end, he couldn't delay any longer, so as he stood up, he handed me a pencil from the table, saying it wasn't much, but at least it was sharp, and rammed up a nostril. It might give me a fighting chance. By now, we were both so pissed that we didn't know what was real or imaginary. But if AF was having me on, he was doing a priceless job of it. The tiny rational voice inside me was saying that such scenarios existed only in the feverish imaginations of bad horror fiction writers, and I was more inclined to concur when AF returned from the bogs unmolested. But then it started. The background music faded, and the place fell deathly quiet, save for a gentle creaking noise, the source of which was the chandeliers slowly swinging from side to side. A thin piece of twine ran along the ceiling and down behind the bar, where one of the staff was rhythmically tugging on it. Then the swaying and chanting began, the whole place rocking back and forth in unison with the chandeliers and singing some twisted arcane pagan hymn. That was it for us. We slammed our pints down and bolted for the door, the cold air hitting us as we legged out into the night, not stopping until our throats were burning with the gasping effort some distance away. We managed to find Gaz's bus, but our efforts to wake him bore no fruit, so AF opted for plan B, retrieving a stage curtain that he'd stashed in the boot, which thankfully was unlocked. At this stage, questions concerning its acquisition went unsaid. I just remember it weighing a ton, and we staggered off looking for somewhere to crash. In sight, further down the field, was a barn, which AF suggested sleeping behind to have some shelter from the wind, and I wearily agreed. The refuge of sleep was all I could think about, and I imagined the curtain delivering an all-enveloping comfort, which when we flopped down, it more than lived up to, and we were out in seconds. I woke the next morning via a process of slowly increasing discomfort, brought about by the sun's ever-growing intensity and the accompanying sense of dehydration. AF lay beside me, snoring merrily away, no doubt lost in the world of dreams. Who knew what vivid subconscious scenarios played out nightly in there? The sound of movement and my pitiful groans awoke him, and he joined in with some guttural noises of his own. Then, upon us jointly realising where we were, we creaked our way upright and headed off into the field beyond the barn. It took a while for the penny to drop, but when it did, it fell with a sickening clatter. The field was empty, apart from one car in the distance, the occupants of which were about to depart. As we drew closer, I recognised some of the previous night's party guests, including Julian Cope lookalike Ellis O'Neill, all-round good egg. His real name was Neil Ellison, but if he repeated it quickly enough, the alter ego emerged, something no doubt stumbled upon after several spliffs. The good egg thing was his own creation, but few could argue with it, as nicer guys are rare indeed. He even had it printed on a business card, and just like egg on a frying pan, it had stuck fast. We quickly realised that much as they'd have liked to help us, the car was full, and with gas long gone, our options amounted to one horrendous choice, hitching. We had about £3 between us, and the others gave us a plastic water bottle that we filled before leaving. AF and I made for strange bedfellows, the chalk and cheese of the band in many ways, so it constituted an interesting plot, the two of us thrown together in adverse conditions. Filmmakers have scored many a hit with thinner fabric to weave, but the sad fact is we didn't discover an unhitherto hidden bond or embark upon a spiritual voyage to eclipse the physical one. We simply got on with it. At times I wanted to throttle him, and I'm sure he felt the same being stuck with a woe is me like myself, but it drove home one point that I'd previously overlooked. AF was the eternal optimist. Despite the fact that the roads were deserted Sunday in Ruralsville, he remained hopeful that someone would come along, and it slowly dawned on me that the stuff he spouted was as much for his own benefit as everyone else's. He didn't so much look on the bright side. It was more that for him there only was a bright side. It was a sunny day. It was nice countryside. There were trees and birds we didn't normally get to see. I rechristened him Pollyanarchist. Even when a lone car did pick us up, only to drop us off again 5 minutes later, his main concern was how long he could keep a straight face. At one point we stopped by a stream and sat with our burr maltreated feet dangling in the water, idly tossing pebbles at darting freshwater fish, and his sole comment was, "It's soundless, innit?" 23 miles later, with still no sign of a lift, his mood wasn't quite so buoyant, but I still hesitate to describe it as negative, more like slightly perplexed, but you can imagine the state of mind I was in. After stopping off in a village shop and stocking up on pop and crisps, he suddenly had a brainwave. "We could ring Biscuit and he'll come and pick us up." Brilliant. It took a mere 27 miles and 7 hours to think of that one. We checked our remaining funds and found that it came to about 19p. So, locating a phone box, he made the call, trying to strike a balance between casual social call and dire emergency. This resulted in the call terminating before Biscuit actually knew where we were, so we were faced with a slight problem. We needed to ring back fast before it was shrugged off as a drunken diversion to last of the summer wine, so there was nothing for it but to knock on a door and ask for change. The guy answering the door looked us up and down a bit before checking his pockets for 10p, which we exchanged for our twos and ones. Had he simply pocketed it, we would have been home free, but when he absently counted it in the automatic way we've all been brought up to do, we had to pathetically admit there was only 8 and make a run for it. As we swiftly strode away, a familiar grin spread across AF's face, and I knew that his trademark cackle wasn't far behind. We returned to the call box, and this time were successful, so we took up position at the rendezvous point, and Biscuit eventually collected us. As we drove back, AF made scattergun conversation in the front, and I sat in the back in a state of shell shock and muted relief, probably wearing the expression normally found on the blood and grease-stained face of every action hero in the last 30 seconds of the film, be it in lifeboat, chopper, or ambulance. Chapter 24, The Organ. At some point during this book, you may have speculated that this whole story is just the product of my imagination. And were you to access the archives of the music press, it would merely corroborate the theory. Little survives to confirm we ever existed, and the little that does is dismissive or downright derogatory. That I can live with, a really bad review, and we had some stinkers, has pushed just as many buttons as a good one, and is driven by the same desire to spread the facts. What really hurts is the invisibility, and once or twice it cut me to the quick. One time in Q magazine, I stumbled across a huge article documenting the rise of the mega dog from its embryonic club dog days at the George Robey to its then current status as travelling unmissable indoor extravaganza. We'd been regular participants in club dog nights, playing the Robey every few months, and it was instrumental in breaking us on the London scene. But that wasn't what I hoped to read about in the article. What got me excited was that it featured small reproductions of memorable Megadog posters along the top of each page. Poisoned Electric had played at the very first with Eat Static, the Rhythmites and Osric Tentacles. It was actually billed as the Club Dog 5th birthday bash at the Rocket, a Megadog. So that's how the name was coined, Surely, such an exhaustive and well-researched article had to feature that seminal poster somewhere. My heart raced as I scanned the little images, checking and rechecking, and then it stopped racing and began sinking. It hadn't been included. Maybe it was such an early event that no copies of the poster survived. So how come I had one on the wall at home? Now it was my mind that was racing, running with one paranoid delusion after another. Were we being systematically airbrushed out of the past, like someone in a Will Smith thriller? You know the drill. A nervous phone call to meet up results in a no-show. So Will calls round to the apartment, except someone else is living there, and there's no shred of evidence that his contact ever existed. Had we somehow joined the witness protection program? Was Poison Electric Head now living as a coffee farmer in Guatemala? Maybe we'd upset the wrong people. It was certainly something we were very good at. We had no qualms about squaring up to music journalists and record companies, naively failing to realise that they could hurt us most by simply denying us a voice. We were probably the only band who had a rejection letter, which we dispatched without fail every time we received a knockback. It was an idea I got from Mad Magazine. In their feature, a failed cartoonist writes to a publisher asking for a rejection slip to complete his collection. But the publisher replies, saying he's got a real talent. Feeling they've misunderstood, he tries again, enclosing one of his dreadful cartoons as proof of his unworthiness. They love it and tell him to keep up the good work, and the process continues with every overture for a rejection letter being replied to with gushing praise. Finally, he buys it, giving up his 9-to-5 and sending them his best work, only to receive, you've guessed it, the standard, "I'm sorry, but it's not what we're looking for right now," response. We'd managed to amass quite a collection ourselves, and each one received the following. Thank you for your rejection letter. We read it with interest, but unfortunately, it's not what we want to hear at the moment. Should you have anything else to say worth hearing, please do not hesitate to contact us. Thanks once again, and we wish you better judgment in the future. Its effectiveness as an antagonistic device is debatable. Most companies no doubt threw it away or ignored it, with the exception of one, Mother Records, the Irish label set up by U2 to help new and struggling artists. Their A&R man responded with such venomous abuse that we felt honour-bound to continue the correspondence. So our next letter acknowledged and agreed with his criticism. It said that thanks to his wise words, we'd sacked 3 band members and given the remaining 4 a badly needed facelift. It went on to outline the growing cutting of hair and the acquisition of sunglasses and a hat. And if he wished to see the results, we'd included before and after pictures. The first was our standard group shot. The second was a photo of U2. That really got his attention, and it wasn't so pleasant after that. We fared little better with the music press. The Enemy once gave us one of their legendary pun taglines, "Our friend's eclectic." But mostly they gave us the cold shoulder, so it's fortunate that a small grassroots fanzine, The Organ, took a shine to us. The Organ was created by Sean Worrell and Marina Anthony, a vibrant couple who loved live music like a junkie needs a fix. Their appetite for new music was insatiable. They could smell it festering underground and dig it up like archaeologists in reverse, painstakingly excavating for clues to the future. They trawled the London night, monitoring every tremor and twitch of the musical landscape, following leads, picking up trails and acting on hearsay or pure intuition. And one night they wandered into one of our shows, some small subterranean backroom with a sticky floor and 5 bands on the bill. For we were deep in the heart of the dreaded toilet circuit. A place where reputations are fought for and dues are paid, and if only the bands were roadies run on autopilot, absently adjusting microphone stands to the height of the next gangly frontman, whilst hopping nimbly over a sea of cables strewn about the black asphalt floor, where torn and faded rotor sound stickers cling grimly to the rusty grills of peeling leatherette wedge monitors, and wisecrack graffiti covers every inch of the shoebox dressing room walls. Where the promoter's name is Spider or Wombat, a whip-thin, bespectacled, ponytailed figure in black drainpipes, docks and a Citizen Fish t-shirt, handing out Access All Areas laminates, even though the All Areas consists of the room you're standing in, the bogs and the car park. Yes, indeed. It was in this battered theatre of dreams that the Organ first encountered Poisoned Electric Head, and we were in fine form, fighting over the piss-weak lager rider and playing dressing room rugby with an empty 3-litre cider bottle. Being from up north, we always felt we had something to prove. Besides, imagine driving all that way, putting up with all the crap it entails, then playing like a bunch of amateurs. No, we much preferred going in there like a Colombian death squad, then disappearing into the night. Sean and Marina liked what they saw and went on to give us some of the best reviews and write-ups any band could wish for. They even went as far as to dub us Best Live Band in Britain, an accolade that modesty begs me to decry, but I can't find it in myself to do so, as for a brief shining spell, it was probably true. I know that at times our vocalists couldn't sing for Toffee, and that we turned in some ragged performances that bordered on the shambolic, and that, unlike most vocalists who affect an American accent when singing, P chose to speak in one in between songs instead. But none of that mattered, because we had magic. Some groups have got it and some haven't, and if you have, then it can compensate for some shortcomings in conventional ability and technique. But if you haven't, then no amount of polished execution, glitz and pizzazz is going to elevate you or the audience to a dimension where anything seems possible, if only for the duration of the song. I've seen and felt it since in my various musical projects after Poisoned Electric Head, but it's always been only fleetingly, like a ghost walking through the room. I don't know, you make your own mind up next time you shell out your hard-earned for a gig. Ask yourself, are they shaking it, faking it and raking it in? Or are they trying to turn ice into fire? Believe it or not, for some people it's just a job. But for me it was like a drug, a faintly promised chance of stepping into another state of consciousness. And only a fool would willingly give up that chance because shoe manufacturers might not like it. Anyway, as far as Sean and Marina were concerned, we kicked ass, and only Cardiacs occupied a closer place in their hearts. The organ is still out there digging in the dirt, staying two steps ahead of any other music magazine you're ever likely to read. So do yourself a favour. Check them out and switch to the other. Chapter 25, Heroes. Don't you hate it when you get to meet your heroes and they turn out to be a nasty piece of work? Or even worse, nothing special, just like you and me. It's hardly their fault. Maybe they've had a bad day and are not feeling too sociable. Or maybe they'll just never be able to live up to that superhuman image you took it upon yourself to construct without their knowledge, consent or approval. So what do? Well, you could always get in there first and ignore them. Or some people like to take it one step further and be rude, aggressive or even violent, thus securing themselves a handy barroom anecdote to trot out to their pissed mates. Me, I prefer the gibbering fool approach. I can't hope to feign some cool aloofness if it's someone I'm really in awe of, so I hope they'll take it as the compliment intended and not be too hard on me. Paul Hartnell from Orbital didn't have the easiest time of it with me, and Florian Schneider from Kraftwerk probably thought I was autistic, but I came away from both encounters walking on air. In our capacity as working musicians, we got to share the stage with some of our heroes, and despite the minefield I've just outlined, each time it turned out to be an honour, a privilege and a pleasure. Arthur Brown. Everybody knows the song Fire. The long-haired proto Alice Cooper with a flaming chalice on his head, roaring the words,
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you...
remains one of the most enduring, iconic images of the 60s. Such immortality comes at a price, however, and Arthur was categorised as a one-hit wonder and swiftly consigned to the Where Are They Now file. For most people, that is, but those lucky enough to have regular exposure to the record collections of Fran and Billy Frog soon discovered there was a lot more to Arthur Brown than a catchy organ riff and a propane hat. An obscure, battered double album containing material from 1968 to 72, entitled The Lost Ears, soon made its mark on us. It was a glorious canon of Hammond-driven psychedelia and was awash with Arthur's trademark falsetto, but also wildly experimental in places and featuring, arguably, one of the first recorded uses of a drum machine. Its other strange quality was that it seemed to defy the imposed limits of the vinyl format and somehow managed to cram hours of wonderful and bizarre music into each of its four sides. Several other later albums also existed, which we tracked down and investigated, including Requiem from 1982, which had a modern electronic sound. It was evident Arthur hadn't remained idle in the years following Fire, but the trail eventually ran cold, and we could only assume that he'd hung up his helmet for good. So imagine our surprise when we heard that not only was he touring again, but that he was coming to St. Helens. Upon hearing the news from the promoter of local venue, The Citadel, I insisted we provide the support, regardless of fee or size restrictions, and he happily agreed. The rest of the band was surprisingly okay about this arrangement, and AF in particular seemed uncharacteristically thrilled at the prospect. He wasn't renowned for bouts of untrammelled enthusiasm,
but in this instance he was positively giddy at the thought. The reason became clear a few weeks later, when we were up to our usual antics in the back of a transit van, heading south for a gig somewhere. The subject of the Arthur Brown support came up, and AF's eyes immediately lit up as he gushed about how great it was going to be. Then in a priceless moment of innocent childlike wonder, he exclaimed, "I hope he sings that one! Get up! Get on up! Get on the scene like a sex machine!" Bless. I can't begin to describe the thrill it gave me to see Arthur Brown in the flesh and to hear that marrow-chilling voice. It hadn't changed, if anything, it had got better, and he positively oozed charisma. And along with Bun and Billy, I wasted no time declaring my admiration of his work to him. We went on to play with Arthur a few more times, the most memorable being when he agreed to join us on stage in his adopted home city of Brighton. We, in turn, agreed to learn a couple of songs from the Lost Ears, and like the album itself, the experience was just something you can't buy or put a price on. And I've got it here. This is the actual recording from that night, Poisoned Electric Head backing Arthur Brown with the song Time Captives.
Zing of a man!
Ah, 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 ah Thank you. That was, Time Captains from an album I've recorded in 1973. When I was just 2 years old. Now we're going to do another one off that album, which was a single,
Spirit of Joy.
It's real.
Past the open landmass with no sun up in the sky, I threw down my skins and opened up the door. The sun came streaming in and it shone out through my eyes. To be no longer quaking on the door. Chase, spirit of joy. Oh, you make the storm survive. Chase, spirit of joy. Oh, you make the love in my soul.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arthur Brown.
Thank you. From my friends, the Poison Electric Head.
Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric. Poisoned electric head. Poisoned electric head.
Poisoned electric.
Poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric,
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 poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric.
Poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric head,
poisoned electric,
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 Poisoned electric head. 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 Poisoned electric head.